The views and opinions expressed here are those of the guests and are not the official position of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
One of the most remarkable aspects of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is its unique history. Throughout the world, great stories from faithful church members have only added to that history. This program shares some of these incredible stories of faith, perseverance, hope, and inspiration. You're listening to Legacy. I'm your host, Nathan Wright. Today, we'll be discussing the publication of the Joseph Smith Papers, specifically subtitled Revelations and Translations. Today in studio with me is Robin Jensen, co-volume editor to the first volume of the Revelation and Translation series of the Joseph Smith Papers Project. Welcome, Robin. Thank you for being here.
It's good to be here.
Please introduce yourself for our listeners, and then let's get a little background on the Joseph Smith Papers Project.
You bet. I'm, as you said, co-volume editor of the first volume of the Joseph Smith Papers, Revelations and Translations series. I have thoroughly enjoyed working on this project and this volume specifically. I've a little bit of my background. I've got a history degree from BYU, master's degree, and then a second master's degree in library and information science with an archival emphasis. So I've been trained to work with historical documents and do that on a daily basis with the Joseph Smith Papers.
Very exciting. I remember the picture of Weldon Anderson. I believe it was the cover of the Church News. I'm not sure. But he's the photographer who's been working with you to get these facsimiles into the book so the readers can actually see the original documents. That's a very exciting thing to be able to see them that way.
It is, absolutely. Part of the Joseph Smith Papers Project's goal is to present the historical documents that mean so much to Latter-day Saints, but also can mean so much to historians in their work on Mormon history. And so in presenting those documents, we felt that what better documents to present to the readers in this form than the revelations themselves. The Joseph Smith received these revelations from God. He claimed their divine authority. And so historians, as they engage with these texts, need to understand that these played an important role in Joseph Smith's lifetime. And so we've done our utmost in presenting these texts to the scholars so that they can not only see these beautiful images, but also the transcriptions as well.
Let's talk a little bit about the origination of the project, how it came about, why now is it finally being published into this big, as I understand it, a huge work, eventually a huge work with lots and lots of volumes. Can you clue us in there a little bit?
You bet. Historians have always wanted access to the documents of Mormon history. I think this first serious attempt in an academic sense was the work of Dean Jesse. He began in the late 60s, early 70s to compile and publish all of the important documents of Mormon history. Obviously, this work had gone on generations before that. I think most Latter-day Saints are familiar with the seven-volume History of the Church that was compiled by B.H. Roberts. That was a similar attempt in publishing, presenting to the world the original source material for interested readers. And we have the same goals, wherein we're presenting original documents to historians and to Latter-day Saints. The only thing that is differed from that original goal is the amount of scholarship, the amount of detail that goes into it. Early 20th century, late 19th century practices of publishing documents, they weren't necessarily concerned with the level of detail that we are today. But historians are known for being very careful, in identifying. Sometimes it comes down to commas or periods, and we take very great care in identifying that level of detail with some of these manuscripts. So Dean Jesse began this work in the late 60s, early 70s, and began publishing Joseph Smith's papers. He was basically a one-man operation, and he did a tremendous amount of work. It soon became apparent that Dean would do this until the day he died, and he still would not finish the work. And so it became apparent to several individuals that more needed to be done. And it all started, like so many things in the world, resources were a difficulty in getting this together. So we had Larry H. Miller, who is known by many individuals as the owner of the Utah Jazz or car dealerships. He caught the history fever. He looked at what Dean Jesse had done and realized that he could help. And so with his support, with other individuals and institutional support, we've been able to expand upon Dean Jesse's earlier work to where we are a fairly large project trying to get our arms around the copious amounts of documents, original documents, dealing with Joseph Smith and the early history of the church. Our commission from the beginning is that we would be publishing these documents largely for a scholarly audience. Clearly, Latter-day Saints will have an interest in these documents. There's nothing like viewing an original document to help us make a connection to our history. But for those familiar with Mormon history done by scholars, it becomes clear that the original source material from which they draw is hit or miss. Sometimes scholars are very good at doing archival research, other times not so well. And so the more we can give Joseph Smith's documents to these scholars, the better the scholarship will be. And that's the entire point of documentary editing, is to facilitate scholars in general to do better research.
Some people outside the church organization would wonder about perhaps the objectivity of what is available and what is being published by the church from this church material. Is that a question that comes up, or what?
Absolutely, yeah. They're scholars, when they find out that this team of scholars are working at the LDS Church publishing documents about Joseph Smith and LDS history, I think that's one of the first questions that comes to mind, is the level of objectivity, the amount of scholarship that goes into the volumes. And some of that is unavoidable. We just cannot combat that with whatever we say. The only thing I think that really will answer people's questions is to see the scholarship itself, to see the volumes. And I think I'm perhaps a biased observer, but from the scholarly reviews, from anecdotal evidence that I've heard, I think most scholars are pleased with the amount of work that we've done, the careful annotation introductions, and the careful transcriptions that we've provided.
Very good. So today we're talking specifically Revelations and Translations, this first volume. It deals with two manuscript revelation books, handwritten text that Joseph dictated to scribes. And can you tell us a little bit about the scribes that the prophet Joseph, who they were and how they worked with him?
Sure. Joseph Smith, from the very beginning, was very hesitant to write things down. There was a letter written in November of 1832 where he laments the fact that he suffers from this narrow prison of pen, paper, and ink. He while very capable, very charismatic in conversations and in preaching orally, when it came down to writing things down, he was much more happy to let scribes do that work. And so from the very beginning, the dictation of the Book of Mormon, he employed the services of scribes. He started with Martin Harris, He used the services of his wife, Emma, and then Oliver Cowdery came onto the scene. So Joseph Smith, from the beginning, dictated much of his work to the scribes. And I think that's an integral part of understanding Joseph Smith's record-keeping practices. When we have a letter written by Joseph Smith in his own hand, it's a very rare occurrence. And so when we look at the Revelation texts, when we look at documents in general, we always have to assume, if it's not in his hand, that there's some link between Joseph Smith and the document itself, and that usually comes in the form of scribes. And it's no surprise then that Joseph Smith's foremost leaders, those that he surrounded himself with, were scribes. You think about Oliver Cowdery. He began his work, he began his role in Mormonism as Book of Mormon scribe. He later became one of the leading elders of the church. Sidney Rigdon served as the scribe to Joseph Smith and the Joseph Smith translation work. John Whitmer was an important leader in Missouri. He served as an important scribe. Frederick G. Williams became counselor in the First Presidency. He was also a scribe. So we see this pattern of Joseph Smith using individuals as scribes, but also giving them great responsibility. In the specific example of these two Revelation books, we have the first Revelation book, which is called a Book of Commandments and Revelations, was largely written by John Whitmer, an early Latter-day Saint, very careful in his scribal work. And there are a few pages within that book that were also written down by Oliver Cowdery. The second manuscript Revelation book, known as the Kirtland Revelation book, was scribed by Frederick G. Williams, Orson Hyde, Oliver Cowdery. And surprisingly enough, as I mentioned before about the rarity of Joseph Smith's handwriting, Joseph Smith himself copied some revelations into this second Revelation manuscript book. So it's intriguing to see the Revelation books as artifacts of the scribes that Joseph Smith surrounded himself with. I think it's also important to understand how the revelations were initially created. These revelation books were important, but they do not seem to be the earliest revelation copies. It seems from all evidence that Joseph Smith, when he dictated a revelation, it was almost spur of the moment. It seems to be that when he dictated a revelation, they used whatever paper was available. They didn't carry these revelation books around all the time with them because they didn't know when Joseph Smith would receive a revelation. So it seems that there was an intermediary step between the initial dictation and these revelation books. And some of those are loose papers whereupon scribes wrote the revelations as dictated from Joseph Smith's mouth. And very few of these, unfortunately, have survived. We have a few instances where it might be the case where they are the original dictation copy. But for the most part, the only manuscript revelations that we have are later copies. That's the case in these Revelation manuscript books, but also the case of other copies. Oftentimes, when an individual joined the Mormon Church, when they were baptized, especially early on, they received a revelation through Joseph Smith, and it would make sense that they would copy that down. So many individuals have notebooks wherein they copied revelations. We have William McClellan had a revelation copied directly into his journal, Zebedee Coltrane, Edward Partridge. All of these individuals seem to if you think about it, the only way early Latter-day Saints had access to the revelations is if they copied it themselves. And so missionaries, just before they went out on their mission, copied some important revelations pertaining to that mission. And so often is the case, you have missionary journals. The very first thing in that missionary journal was Section 20, for instance, a revelation on how to run the church. So the stage of revelation record keeping begin with the original dictated copy and then other early copies made by individuals. And then finally, we have these official or semi-official revelation books wherein it seems that they're comprehensively copying all known revelations into one volume, especially in the case of the Revelation Book 1 or the Book of Commandments and Revelations.
So these two Revelation books you're describing, physically, how big are they, were they?
They're a little bit bigger than a standard piece of paper today, an 8 by 11 page. A little bit bigger than that. The first Revelation book has about 200 pages. The second one, there were only about 120 pages written in the volume, although the volume itself was much larger than that, but there are a lot of blank pages in that book. So if you think of an old-time ledger book where store clerks would write their receipts or other notes in that, that's often the case or what these volumes would look like. The Kirtland Revelation book has this beautiful marbling paper on the cover. The Book of Commandments and Revelations, actually, through the subsequent use of that volume, the covers were removed and some of the pages were removed from the volume, and we can talk about that later. But the Book of Commandments and Revelations has a very used, worn feel to it, which to me is fabulous. I love to see these old documents and see that they were not only originally created, but they were used so much. You can see from the physical artifact itself what these revelations meant to the early Latter-day Saints through their use.
And we have on the table here a copy of the book we're talking about. And would you describe to our listeners its size and about it, please?
This volume is an oversized volume. It's the most of our volumes perhaps seem a little larger than most books, but this is even larger. The pages themselves are they have a glossy feel, almost as if it's a coffee table book. And each page, as you open up the book, there's a two-page spread. On the left-hand side of the page, there's this beautiful photograph of the manuscript page itself, and then on the right-hand side of the book is the transcription. And so the entire published volume contains every single inscribed page of these Revelation manuscript books. Most of our other volumes contain contextual illustrations where we provide a illustration of a page to give readers the sense of what the book might feel. But this volume truly gives every single page so that you can go through, not only look at the transcription and read it, but you can look at the manuscript and see the ink spills or the other markings in the volume that really give it the characteristics, the beauty of this old document.
So the actual photograph of the manuscript page is pretty close to original size.
It is, yeah. It's a little bit. We've had to reduce it just a little bit, but it's about the same size as the original book. In addition to the photographs and the transcriptions, we've also provided some introductions that help readers understand what the books are, their history. We've also provided some annotation or footnotes to help readers understand what's going on with the transcription or the text. Sometimes there are things that even with the photographs you can't entirely see, such as pinholes, which in some cases give meaning of what the text, how the text was used. Even scratches, there are scratches in the book that give meaning to the text. And so we describe some of that in the footnotes. And then there's charts and other material in the back that, again, help readers understand how these books fit into the context of early Mormon record keeping and Mormon history in general.
So just before coming into this interview, I was online and saw a couple of pages in the spread of both sides, and the printed version, the transcription, I guess you call it, actually has the cross outs just like it does on the other side, just to give you a feel of the changes and the how it actually was flowing, I guess, the workflow of how they did it.
Yeah, as I said earlier, scholars are very careful in how they approach some of these texts, and we wanted to present the manuscripts as they exist today. And there are many, as you can imagine, in handwriting some of these revelations, you make mistakes, you do misspellings, other errors need to be corrected, and so they strike through words, they write above the lines, they go back and add text to the manuscript page. All this is indicated in the transcription itself. And to make matters even more complicated, especially in the case of the first Revelation manuscript book, A Book of Commandments and Revelations, this volume was taken to Missouri in the early 1830s and was used as the source for printing the Revelations there in Missouri. And so W.W. Phelps and others went through and edited the manuscripts as simple as, in some cases, adding punctuation, adding versification, correcting some of the errors. All of that is found in the manuscript book itself. So in the transcription, we've provided all of these changes in different colors depending on who the scribe was. If W.W. Phelps went through and versified a revelation, all those numbers are found in blue as opposed to black. Oliver Cowdery has his own color. Joseph Smith is in bold. Anything that he added is in bold. So you can go through, look at the images, and you can see that multiple individuals wrote on one page. And then looking at the transcription, you can identify who those individuals were.
So coming from a place where I wouldn't understand everything about it, how do you know who did what on the transcript and the manuscript?
There are some cases where large phrases or sometimes even single words, individuals wrote different enough that you can identify who they were. So you become familiar enough with the individual's handwriting that you know instinctively who that is. Other times, it's not so easy. There are cases where there's a single letter added to a word. For instance, to correct the spelling, they added one letter. It's almost impossible to identify who that is. But this is where looking at the entire page comes into handy. If you've identified a word as being in Sidney Rigdon's handwriting, and then you look down and see that that letter is added in the exact same ink color, then you know that that is likely Sidney Rigdon. In the days of, well, at this time they mixed their own ink through with powder. Sometimes you had your own recipe of making your ink. So most all inks are different and they age differently. And so looking at the different shades of the ink or the different ink flow on this page, you can identify sometimes where it, looking at just the handwriting, it wouldn't be clear.
So this is to be two volumes. Is that what I understand, this Revelations and Translations, or are there going to be more?
The Joseph Smith Papers Project is divided into several different series. The journal series, the document series, the Revelations and Translations series, all of these series have different volumes intended. The journal series, for instance, we've published the first volume. There's going to be three volumes in that series that will publish. That series will contain the entire journals of Joseph Smith. The Revelations and Translation series will contain this volume, which is the first and second Revelation books. We will also be publishing the printed canon. Joseph Smith you could argue one of the very first acts he did was publish the Book of Mormon. He also saw that the Revelations were published as well. In 1833, they attempted to publish the Book of Commandments. In 1835, they published the first edition of the Doctrine and Covenants. So we will be reproducing some of those printed works. And then also we will be producing the Book of Mormon manuscript and some of the other early Revelation manuscripts. So this is the first volume of the Revelations and Translations series, but there will be subsequent volumes which will include other canon. We will also be including on our website manuscripts, both the scanned images and transcriptions of those manuscripts online, and that's at josephsmithpapers.org.
Very good. As far as this specific volume, what is the time span of Revelations covered?
The Revelations in both of these volumes cover from the first Revelation written down, which was in 1828, all the way through about 1835. When you look at all the Revelations given to Joseph Smith, there's a very apparent pattern in the reception of the Revelations. Up through about 1835, Joseph Smith received many revelations. If you open up your modern edition of the Doctrine and Covenants, most of the revelations found in the Doctrine and Covenants cover from the Book of Mormon translation period, 1828, up through about 1835. Thereafter, Joseph received fewer revelations. And so these two revelation books, while they only cover the first 5 years of the church's organization, contain a large majority of the revelations received. So the revelation books themselves, the first one was created sometime in 1831, retrospectively copying the earlier revelations. And the second revelation manuscript book was begun in 1832. Both of them stopped being used around 1835, likely due to the fact that they published the Doctrine and Covenants in 1835, and these were no longer needed because they had the published revelations.
So you mentioned our modern day Doctrine and Covenants. What shall we say percentage of what this book contains is in our current Doctrine and Covenants?
This volume, the first volume of the Revelation Translation Series, has approximately from section 1 through about section 105 or so. And there are, that covers the first 100 or so sections. And the current Doctrine and Covenants goes through about 136 with some of the other, goes through about 138. Then we have the official declarations 1 and 2. But it covers most of Joseph Smith's, as I said before, most of Joseph Smith's revelations. Only the revelations not covered in these volumes are those basically received in late Kirtland period and then into Missouri and Far West and Nauvoo.
A process that may or may not apply to this particular book or this type of scribe is when, let's say, the prophet Joseph was giving a sermon and someone was actually writing what he said down. Is it shorthand? Is it speed writing? Do we know how this was done?
It's actually an interesting contrast because there is a difference between Joseph Smith simply giving a sermon and Joseph Smith dictating a revelation. I'll start with a sermon. We do have several accounts, especially into Nauvoo, where individuals are attempting to capture Joseph Smith's words as he speaks them in a sermon. And I say attempting because they don't succeed in getting all the words down. Joseph Smith, it appears, is speaking fairly quickly, and so they do the best they can in writing things down longhand with these sermons. So you've got kind of broken language. You've got just the core concepts that Joseph Smith is speaking found in these sermon reports. It's very different than what we see in the Revelations. And in fact, we have several reminiscent accounts giving the process of how Joseph Smith dictated a revelation. The accounts basically say that the scribe made himself ready, sat down at a table with pen and paper, and then Joseph Smith began to dictate. And several of the accounts say that he dictated fairly slowly, and so that the scribe could write down in longhand everything that Joseph Smith wrote, or everything Joseph Smith said. And thereafter, when the entire revelation was complete, the scribe would then read back to Joseph Smith what the scribe had written down, as a precaution that they got everything that was needed. And so I think Joseph Smith, in giving the dictated revelation, understood the limitations of the scribe. They didn't know shorthand, or they didn't use shorthand. They had to write it out in longhand, and therefore Joseph Smith spoke fairly slowly and carefully. So it seems to be that Joseph Smith was conscious of the fact that he was dictating these texts to someone writing them down, whereas with sermons, he's just speaking and not aware or understanding that the scribes would do the best they could, but isn't the text, the oral text, isn't about having someone write it down. It's about the listeners hearing it.
So you mentioned that these two Revelation books sort of were made from loose papers, so to speak, whenever the revelations happened. And were there other copies of these two Revelation books made, or was it a one-of-a-kind?
These are both unique, one-of-a-kind. There are some revelations found in both Revelation books.
I see.
And that has to do mainly with the history of both of the books, and maybe I can talk a little bit about that. The first one, the Book of Commandments and Revelations, was begun by John Whitmer in 1831. John Whitmer was appointed church historian and was commanded to transcribe all things given to Joseph Smith. So John Whitmer, it seems, created this book in response to that section 47. So this revelation book was the church historian's copy, compiling all the revelations into one volume. In November of 1831, the church decided to publish the revelations, and they appointed John Whitmer and Oliver Cowdery to go to Missouri with the revelations to publish them in not only the newspaper, the Evening and the Morning Star, but in what was called a Book of Commandments. So John Whitmer took his book, the Book of Commandments and Revelations, to Missouri, leaving apparently no other revelation book in Kirtland or in Hiram, Ohio, with Joseph Smith. Shortly thereafter, in early 1832, Joseph Smith likely has someone start the second revelation book, the Kirtland Revelation book. So it appears that beginning in 1832, we have two books concurrently being created in Ohio and in Missouri. And what seems to happen, Joseph Smith receives and dictates a commandment in Ohio. They make a copy of it, send it to Missouri, where they copy that commandment into the Revelation book. So it's basically many of the revelations received in 1832 or after are copied in both books, although there are exceptions to that rule.
You talked about Missouri and the printing of the Book of Commandments down there. One of my favorite stories is the Rollins sisters, Caroline and Mary Elizabeth Rollins, who heroically saved some of the pages after the mobsters had thrown them out on the street. What's the connection between those pages and these two books of Revelation?
I think Joseph Smith, the church leaders, understood fairly quickly that they could not continue to provide Revelation copies to Latter-day Saints simply by copying them down. And I think it became apparent that they needed to publish these revelations to the church and to the world in general. So at this November of 1831 conference, they appointed, as I said earlier, Oliver Cowdery, John Whitmer, to publish the revelations. So they took Revelation Book 1, the Book of Commandments and Revelations, to Missouri, where that was the source that they used to publish the revelations. They set in type the revelations from this book and published five gatherings or signatures of the Book of Commandments. Unfortunately, relationships between early Latter-day Saints in Missouri and the non-Mormon neighbors soured. And in July of 1833, the printing office was destroyed by this by a Missouri mob. The Book of Commandments was not complete. It seems that the editors, the publishers were intending at least one more gathering. And when I say gathering, the way that they printed back then and today, you print one large sheet, you fold it in several ways, and that makes, in this case, 32 pages of a book. So it seems that they were intending for at least one more of those gatherings, but because of the interruption, the Book of Commandments is basically an incomplete book. And so you have this story of the Rollins sisters. You have actually several other individuals who claim that they went through and saved some of the pages. And that violent disruption of the printing is evidenced today. The Book of Commandments is one of the most rarest books of Mormon history. There's less than a couple dozen surviving today. And it's an extreme, as I said before, when you look at these Revelation manuscript books, you can see how much the Revelations meant to the early Latter-day Saints through their use and how much they were used. But the Book of Commandments is the same way, where this is a newly born church, not yet, you know, just over 3 years old in July of 1833. And it took an extreme amount of resources to publish these revelations. And you can see in this action the amount of care and the amount of care they placed upon these revelations. So the Book of Commandments, the 1833 Book of Commandments, we can see a direct correlation between that and the first Revelation manuscript, the Book of Commandments and Revelations. Those two titles are somewhat confusing. The manuscript book is Book of Commandments and Revelations. The printed book is Book of Commandments. But and perhaps we can get into this a little bit, Book of Commandments, we knew that the printers had something to publish this book, but until recently, we did not know about the existence of the Book of Commandments and Revelations. This manuscript book only recently came over to the Joseph Smith Papers Project from the First Presidency Office, and we were able to publish this book, this manuscript book, which helps us gain better appreciation for the printing of these revelations, and it helps us understand how the revelations were printed, the actual process, and what types of changes or editing took place on the manuscript books.
You mentioned the evidence of how much the saints used these by the wear and tear, I suppose. As I go into the church museum store, I see the little reproductions of the Book of Commandments, and just it was basically small enough that you could carry it with you anywhere. And so evidently that's exactly what they did, as much as they could.
I think that was the intent, to make it small enough that missionaries could carry it around in their pocket, that you could read from. One of the I'm intrigued with, we have at the Church History Library Wilford Woodruff's personal copy of a Book of Commandments. And it's fun to see, not only because this is such a rare item, but the last commandment, the last revelation published in the Book of Commandments was chapter 64 or section 65 of the current Latter-day Saint Scripture, Doctrine and Covenants. But that chapter ended before the actual revelation was complete. So Wilford Woodruff, when he bound the Book of Commandments together, finished copying the revelation. And then he continued and copied in other revelations and other hymns, so that he basically had in this pocket-sized book the commandments given to the church and the hymns that they sang in the meetings, so that it was clearly something that he used in his ministry, his missionary work, his worship service. And what's also interesting, these books, the Book of Commandments was, as I said, never finished, so individuals had to bind it themselves. They had to take it to someone who would bind it, or they – sometimes you see copies that just literally someone, you can tell, hand-sewed, hand-stitched the gatherings together. Wilford Woodruff if you look at the Book of Commandments and his very first journal, they're bound in the exact same manner and the same size. So you have here Wilford Woodruff's copy of the Revelations, the divine scripture, and his journal, which, as many historians know, is such a critical source in early Mormon history. He was not only conscious and aware and reading the sacred commandments, but he was also creating his own records and making his the records of his own sacred experiences.
Very insightful. Speaking of that, what insights do you think that this volume gives you and all the rest of us on the life of the prophet Joseph Smith?
I think there's insight at so many levels. We, as I said earlier, we're focusing on a scholarly audience, and so the insight to a historically motivated individual are many. Someone approaching this volume with many questions can have many of those questions answered. There are nuances and information that is just critical when you look at it from a historical perspective. I think Latter-day Saints can really appreciate this volume because of the connection that it gives. I think there's, not to demean in any way Scripture, because I think we all understand the importance of Scripture, but when we open up the Doctrine of Covenants, the modern Doctrine of Covenants, it's set in type. There's such a it's published. There's this feel that it's published and it's always been published, and we take for granted the history of the Revelations. We don't think about how the Revelations were copied over and over and over again. We don't understand that if saints were interested in obtaining the word of the Lord, they needed to spend hours and hours in copying their own commandments. And I think, therefore, we can have this connection to the early Latter-day Saints. The early Latter-day Saints placed so much emphasis on the Revelations, and they practiced the Revelations. When the Revelations commanded them to build a temple, they did it. When they commanded the saints to move thousands of miles, they did it. And I think we can gain a better appreciation for the early Latter-day Saints' reliance upon the Revelations by looking at these manuscript books. It's just, why are there lines and lines with dozens and hundreds of people lining up to see the Declaration of Independence? I think these documents really have an important connection to our history, and I think it's the same with these Revelations. When we view the original manuscripts, it becomes, at least in my experience, it becomes a little bit more real. We see that there's this physical connection with the past. And I think that's very important to keep in mind. On a final level, I don't think having access to the original manuscripts, viewing them, even, you know, I've seen the originals of these documents, having all of that can't replace your own personal testimony of the Revelations. I don't think, on a certain level, I'm not at any advantage than any other Latter-day Saint in truly understanding the divine origin of the Revelations, because we all have access to the Holy Ghost and the witness that can give to the Revelations.
So in a final format of what can help a person, mostly what we have in the Doctrine and Covenants is enough.
Yep. For as much as the historian side of me, for as much as it pains the historian side of me, it really is true that when you open up your current Doctrine and Covenants and when you prayerfully read through those texts, you can have just as much access to the divine origin of those than reading out of this book, out of the Joseph Smith Papers book or any other manuscript book. The Holy Ghost is testified to the early Latter-day Saints of these truthfulness, the truthfulness of these records, and I think that with prayerful attitude, he will testify of these texts to us in whatever form they may come.
So those who are interested, it is a huge volume, and big books take money to produce and take money to purchase. How accessible is this volume going to be to someone who can't afford a $90 book?
Eventually, it's not up yet, but eventually anything in this volume will be on the website. And so internet access will be the only thing that is the prohibiting factor, which in some cases will be prohibiting. But we try to make these texts as available as we possibly can. And we do understand that the volume is expensive, and we don't expect every Latter-day Saint to go out and purchase one, because that is, in some cases, prohibitive. So on the website, there will be information there in the future. I guess in large centers of Mormon population, you can always go to the library or things like that.
And even, as I mentioned, it was the Deseret Book site that I saw a few pages, which gives a real feel of what this volume is all about.
Yeah.
To finish up, are there any interesting experiences that you would want to share with us about the creation of this volume and that you'd want to share with us?
This volume of the Joseph Smith Papers Project has had, I'm listed as co-volume editor with Robert Woodford and Steve Harper. But the three of us, there's a tremendous team behind the three of us, from the production editors to the photographer, Weldon Anderson, as you said. I think this is a tribute to the project in general and how many people contributed to this volume. I think to look back on this volume and how it was published, there were just so many things that fell in place. And I think that there were, as you can imagine, producing something like this takes a lot of time, a lot of discussion of how do we exactly present it, what type of format do we want, even to the very small details of font and size and how does this look, things like that. It seemed to all fall in place, and it was a tremendous opportunity to see that happen. I think as we look at the Joseph Smith Papers Project, and again, I'm not the unbiased by any means, but I think this will be one of the crowning jewels of the Joseph Smith Papers Project, not only because it is a beautiful book. It's very nice to look at, but the content was so important to the early Latter-day Saints. It can be so important to the current Latter-day Saints. And to truly understand the mind of Joseph Smith, to truly understand the minds of the early Latter-day Saints, I think scholars need to engage in the Revelation texts themselves.
Thank you very much. We've been talking with Robin Jensen, the co-volume editor to the first volume of the Revelation and Translation series of the Joseph Smith Papers Project. Robin, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you. It's been good to be here.